Possible by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, presenting Origins of a Networked World, From World War II to the Internet, on Thursday, February 17th at 3 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On this program, every day, Monday through Friday, our live conversations cover a wide range of topics. On every program, we do our best to provide you with an interesting discussion on a wide range of topics, providing enough time to both our guests and to you, the caller. Coming up today, we're going to talk about language with Patricia O'Connor, writer and editor. Please show us that you value the guests and discussions you hear here on this program Monday through Friday. Make a call to 217-244-9455 and make a pledge right now. That number again, 244-9455. Call in today during the program with a pledge of $60 or more, and you may request as your thank you gift a copy of our guest's book, Woe Is I, The Grammar Phobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. This is available this afternoon with a pledge of $60 or more. In Pledge Central this afternoon, editor Maeve Riley. She is the editor of our program guide, Patterns. Hi, Maeve.
Hi, Celeste. And I just want to say a quick thanks to James Fortner, who called in already and has gotten his copy of the softcover book, Woe Is I. So thank you, James. And I hope you'll join James and get a copy of the book and make the world a better place for the English language. Give us a call, 217-244-9455.
And we've got a challenge on the table,
yes,
too.
We do. There's a law professor who will pay $10 of the $25 student membership for WILL for the first 15 law students who pledge. So if you're a law student and you love language, which I know most law students do, give us a call, 217-244-9455.
And we accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. And for that pledge of $60 or more, we'll be happy to send you Woe Is I, The Grammar Phobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. We'll check back with Maeve. I hear a phone ringing.
Yes.
That's good news. We'll check back with you, Maeve, later in the hour.
Okay.
Okay, great. Maeve Riley. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Language is our topic in this portion of the program. Our guest is Patricia O'Connor. She's a writer, commentator, and former editor at the New York Times Book Review. She's the author of three books on language and writing, including Woe Is I. She loves language, its delights and its challenges. She calls it a glorious invention. And here's how she begins the introduction to Woe Is I. We all come from the factory wired for language. By the time we know what it is, we've got it. She also notes language isn't perfect. It has flaws. Of English, she says, if it weren't so stretchy and unpredictable, though, we wouldn't have Lewis Carroll, Dr. Seuss, or the Marx Brothers. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions about language, grammar. Our guest, Patricia O'Connor, will be happy to talk with you. Join us with a telephone call. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, or the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, you can call the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to Woe Is I, Patricia O'Connor is the author of Words Fail Me, What Everyone Who Writes Should Know About Writing. And with Stuart Kellerman, You Send Me, Getting It Right When You Write Online. You can find Patricia O'Connor online at www.grammarphobia.com. If you'd like to talk with her this afternoon, give us a call, in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the second time Patricia O'Connor has been a guest on this program, and I'm happy to welcome her back. Patricia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Have you seen or heard anything wonderfully stretchy or unpredictable in the language lately?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because I just this morning, I've been reading Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott,
mm-hmm.
and it's just something I never read, and I thought, well, it's probably my duty. But I was reading a section of it where someone's being held in a dungeon, and he looks up and he sees some light coming through a chink in the masonry of this stone castle, and it's referred to as a loophole.
Wow.
L-O-O-P-H-O-L-E. Well, I'd never come across the original meaning of loophole. Loophole as it was originally meant to be, and it was originally an opening in a stone wall so that people inside could peer out and also shoot arrows at attackers.
Ah.
And loop meant, was from an old Dutch word meaning to peer. And it comes, actually, it gives us also the expression, the jeweler's loop. You know that a jeweler looks through this little eye scope,
mm-hmm.
and it's called a jeweler's loop when he examines a gem. That loop is for peer, to peer at something.
Oh.
So at any rate, that's something I just learned today.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting.
Yeah, I'm always running across things like that.
It was interesting. Last night I was reading the paper, and of course I was thinking to myself, well, tomorrow I'm going to talk with Patricia O'Connor. And so I was kind of, I don't know, a little bit more aware of language last night for some reason. Anyway, I was reading the newspaper, and I came across this sentence. Academic freedom requires that professors not be punished because they express repugnant or nitwitted ideas. And, you know, when I think of nitwit, I think of the word as a noun. And here it was used as an adjective, and I just thought that was great fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, English is that kind of language. We can we make adjectives out of adverbs. We make adverbs out of adjectives, nouns out of verbs, like, well, the making of verbs into nouns actually is, the Greeks have done that. It's been done for thousands of years. But, yeah, we have a very, very flexible language. And that bothers a lot of people because it does allow so much flexibility that sometimes you wonder what people are talking about. But it allows us great creativity, great license, and great opportunity for nuance and for creativity.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with a caller, a listener in Terre Haute on line 4. You're on the air with Patricia O'Connor. Good afternoon.
Hi, folks. How are you doing today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Hey, Patricia, I had a question. It came from childhood. I always remembered seeing it, and it always bugged me.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I took a look at a history book, it always said an history instead of a history.
Mm.
What's the deal here? It's
with
not
that.
An hippopotamus.
Good, yeah, good question. If you ever read English novels, you'll find a lot of times that words that start with H, even though it's an aspirated or sounded H, like hotel or history or humbug, if there's an article in front of it, often it will be an instead of a. That is a reference to the fact that often those H's were not pronounced in Britain.
Uh-huh.
But here we pronounce them. Any H that is sounded like, history, hotel, Halliburton, anything like that, we use a in front of it. If the H is silent, like our or herb, then we use an in front of it.
So it would be an herb?
An herb. I mean, you know, like a... like.
I guess
steak,
I do say that,
parsley.
Yeah, okay.
Not herb like the man's name.
No, I got you. No, then it would never be a herb anyway, so.
No.
No. Okay, well, that's interesting.
But, you know, it's not so much the letter that that determines whether you have a A or an in front of it. It's the sound.
Excellent.
The same is true of Y's and W's and everything else that might or might not be sounded. So.
All right. Well, hey, I appreciate you clearing that up for me. It's bugged me for nearly 30 years now.
So. Thanks for the call. Why is it that, you know, sometimes we have these spellings where we don't pronounce mm-hmm. letters that are part of the word, like mm-hmm. Lamb mm-hmm. or comb.
Right.
Or hour.
Uh-huh.
Were those letters ever once upon a time pronounced?
Well, that's a good question. Let me use an example. The word right, R-I-G-H-T, and also night, K-N-I-G-H-T.
Mm-hmm.
We might wonder, what is that G-H in the middle, and why don't we say rigged or nigged? And the reason is that those are old Anglo-Saxon words. And at one time, those letters were actually pronounced. Like the word that we know now as knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, might once have been pronounced knicht.
Mm.
And so all those old, very, what look like eccentric spellings to us is just an example of a word carrying its history around with it.
Mm.
And the same with lamb and comb. At one time, those may have been pronounced letters. Usually, a word that ends in MB or has an MB sound in it also is from Anglo-Saxon. You know that English is essentially a Germanic language.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of Latin vocabulary, but we have a Germanic structure, and most of our words come from Anglo-Saxon.
Mm.
So comb and lamb are examples of Anglo-Saxon.
So once upon a time, the knicht might have drawn his sword.
His sword, yes, exactly.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Patricia O'Connor. She's a writer and editor, author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. Listeners, you can join us with questions and comments this afternoon about language and grammar. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Patricia, this book was first published in 1996, Woe Is I.
Yes.
And then you revised the book in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to make a lot of revisions?
Well, there were not a lot, but it was enough so that it changed the book considerably. When I originally did it, I told the publisher that I said, "Look, this is a very fluid subject,
mm-hmm.
and since I deal a lot with usage and not just the rules of grammar, as you know, the rules of grammar don't change overnight, but usage does." Pronunciations do. New phrases come into being and go out of being. Clichés are born and die. Mostly are born, don't die. So I felt that I ought to take another look at it after about 5 years. And actually, it was 7 years later that the next edition was published. And I hope that someday there will be a third, but not in the very near future. But yeah, there were things that changed. And I added an entire chapter on email
mm-hmm.
because it seemed to me that it was becoming such an important means of communication. And what was different about it was that it was getting people writing again. And I think it's probably done more to revive writing among just, you know, the guys on the street than anything. It's made a major change in the way a lot of people communicate.
Yeah.
So I felt that it deserved a chapter all to itself.
Yeah, and that chapter is Email Intuition.
Mm-hmm.
Does Anything Go? And we've had a listener call in who had a question in this area, can't stay on the line with us, mm-hmm. but was wondering if the computer, the internet, email has wrecked us.
Well, that's a good question. A lot of people have suggested as much. But the way I look at it is that the computer didn't cause all the problems that we have with language. It didn't cause us to be lousy spellers. It didn't cause us to not know how to make subjects and verbs agree. The computer can't be blamed for all this stuff. The computer has actually brought it to our attention. So it's like the messenger that gets all the flack for bringing the bad news. But I think for that very reason, it's good that online communication has come along to show us where our weaknesses are, because we can't get away any longer with not being able to communicate in writing. You can fake your way through life pretty easily if you just use the telephone all day long. And if you never sent a letter or a card or wrote anything down. But now I think people are being reminded why it's important to know how to write.
Yeah. Well, certainly if you send someone an email, it could be forwarded to many, many people. That,
right.
That should give one pause right there.
Right. Your mistakes can be greatly magnified in email. Another thing about email to remember is that not only do you write it very quickly, but it gets read very quickly by the recipient. The person might give it the merest glance before deleting it, because he doesn't have all day to sit there and stare at his screen. So you have to make sure that you get your point across correctly, because it's not as though you've sent a letter that a person is going to be rereading or have around for later reference or that kind of thing. People tend to want to absorb the message that's in an email instantly, and the better you've communicated yourself, the better off that person is going to be who's getting the message.
Yeah, things go from the inbox to the outbox very
quickly.
Yeah,
and how many times have you gotten a confusing email and sent back a question, and then that person has to answer your question, and that gives rise to something else, which gives rise to something else. And you've basically wasted a lot of time with backing and forthing, all because someone didn't express himself very clearly in an email.
Yeah.
So, it's all the more reason to give it a little bit more attention than you might otherwise do.
Yeah.
It doesn't take very long to reread an email before sending it.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe you should pick up the phone.
Yeah. Now, that's something else. People, even in the same offices, will shoot someone an instant message or an email when, why not get up and stretch your legs and go remind yourself what the person's face looks like? Have a conversation. I think too often we're letting our fingers do the walking.
Yeah, yeah. Or there's the person who sends you an instant message and then calls you. Did you get my message?
Right, right.
It's like that goes to the speed of the medium.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line in Indiana, line 4. Hi.
Hello. Well, I got one to beat that one. I'm retired now, but I worked in a lab. And we had guys and gals who sit in chairs back to back.
Mm-hmm.
There was a small little aisle to walk between them, and they would email each other.
I believe it.
You got to believe it. It happened.
Yeah.
And I used to scratch my head and say things to them, and they would just say, you're just an old man. You don't know what the hell's happening now. I went, God's sakes, If they all backed up at the same time, they clunk heads.
Yeah, exactly.
But I had the question I really wanted to ask is when I was younger, I brought it up with that history thing with the and.
Mm-hmm.
We were taught, I remember, and before vowels and mm-hmm. A for everything else except H. Now, I know a lot of this has changed, but I haven't looked at a grammar book in years, and you know, in sense it was intended for younger children learning how to write and verbalize and stuff. Do they have new rules that they teach, or do they teach any rules at all? And, you know, I remember there was these set things we'd read about mm-hmm. E before I, except after C, and blah. Mm-hmm. There were a number of them. I'm sure most of them I've forgotten mm-hmm. now, but I wonder if we have a new generation of those things that that may appear on the scene or there or whatever.
What you're asking is a really complicated question, and I'll try to be brief about it. But when I was in school, and probably when you were in school, we actually had classes in grammar, in English grammar. Maybe you diagrammed sentences.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you remember that?
Well, who doesn't?
Yeah. Right. Around the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s, people started thinking that it hurt children's self-esteem or it impeded their creativity or whatnot to be corrected in their English. Eventually, English books were basically dumped on the scrap heap of the American curriculum. Only now is English grammar making its way back into schools, and the problem is that our young teachers themselves haven't had grammar, and so they don't know how to teach it. It's very easy to take something out of the curriculum, but it's hard to put it back in. So it's a big problem for a lot of school systems now that want to reintegrate grammar into their teaching. And for many years, a lot of them have either had no formal English grammar or they've relegated it to a single unit in something called language arts, which might be reading or a lot of other things. So I salute America's educators who are trying to bring back grammar because they've got a big job ahead of them. I get mail all the time from young teachers saying, you know, I'd like to start correcting papers, but I don't know where to begin. What's correct and what's not? I'm not joking. And I once spoke at a high school in New Jersey, and the principal of the high school came up to me before my talk, and he wanted to apologize beforehand because he and one of the coaches had to leave early, so they would have to leave halfway through my talk. And what he said was, him and me have to go early. Him and me have to go early.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is what we're, and he was probably in his late 30s, I suppose. So this is what we're faced with. Educators who themselves don't know proper English trying to pass it on to kids. So we have a big job ahead of ourselves, but it's starting to be recognized now, I think, what we've lost by taking grammar out of the curriculums of the public schools.
Yeah. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. Patricia, is your book used as a textbook?
It's not used as a textbook, but it is used as a supplementary text in a lot of colleges and in a lot of private school systems. In like the junior high and high school level.
Well, it's such a lot of fun, and I remember I diagrammed sentences too. And
yeah, it wasn't fun. I'm not saying it was fun.
Yeah, and you know, maybe it shouldn't be. I mean, not everything needs to be fun.
Yeah.
But if you approach a subject and you grab a student's attention and you make it interesting,
right. Also, if you're not afraid to correct the student and say, you know, we all make mistakes. That was a mistake right there, and it would be better if you wrote it this way.
Mm-hmm.
But now that you know, it seems that the fact that a child writes, say, a short story or paper, whatever, and turns it in, it's supposed to be a success just because he or she did it. And granted, there is a triumph in there. The kid made the effort.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you do a kid a favor by not giving him or her some guidance about what's a better way to say this. Or, you know, we don't teach approximate math or approximate history. Why teach approximate English?
Yeah. Once upon a time, I saw the poet Gwendolyn Brooks working with young students in a library setting, and she took great care to correct them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was great, and I hadn't seen anyone, you know, do that so beautifully with students.
But, right. It doesn't have to be a traumatic experience.
Right. Let's talk with another listener. A caller in Chicago on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. As someone who grew up in England a long time ago, a lot of what you're saying is delightful to hear. And I have three children who've learned in the American way and can write but can't write. I'm curious about the different use of the word that as an apparently preferred term to which in or who the person that which. From my recollection, is a sort of more ugly sound than to speak about someone who is doing something. Particularly in written speech, it loudly calls attention to itself when I'm reading.
Right. Are you talking about the difference between that and which, or between which and who?
Well, both I think are related, but the use of the word that as a substitute for.
Or whom.
Is it because one can avoid the struggle about whether the word has an M at the end of it?
Or right. It does allow you to get out of that problem about whether to use who or whom if you use that.
That's a fairly sophisticated problem, though, and
yes,
I'm not sure how many people would be aware of it.
Right, it is. But on the other hand, when I wrote my book, I researched that issue of whether you can refer to a person as a that. As in, I want a girl just like the girl that married dear old dad. That always sounded wrong to my ear. But I did a little research, and I found that there's no grammatical foundation for that belief. A person can be either a that or a who. A thing can only be a that.
I thought... It might be to do with if a person is the subject of the next part of it, then it would be who, or I would like if it's the object, I would like a child like that. Then that makes some sense to me. But
that's using that in a different way. That's using it right as a different kind of a pronoun than the one you're talking about when you're talking about using it as a subject.
So then why would I have grown up knowing that it was wrong to use the word that, and it glares at me every time I see it?
Well, there are a lot of things that you may think are incorrect that aren't. For example, you may think that it's incorrect to split an infinitive. Am I right?
Well, it's a struggle around, yes. Elegant English eats pandas and dies.
Oh, yeah, right. Well,
eats shoots and leaves.
I won't get started on that one. But you probably also think that it's incorrect to end a sentence with a preposition, right?
That was how we were taught. I think
ignored. Those are two more examples of myths about English grammar that are untrue. I have a chapter in my book about myths about grammar, and it's not as though these were once recognized rules that everyone followed. They've been myths from the very beginning that were argued over from time immemorial. In the case of the preposition at the end of a sentence and the split infinitive, that was an attempt in the 18th century to graft the rules of Latin grammar onto English. And the Latinists were very influential, as you know, in the universities at Oxford and Cambridge. In fact, classes were taught in Latin at Oxford for hundreds of years. So these people had a lot of influence. But real scholars of language were arguing almost immediately that, well, why would you graft a rule of a Romance language onto a Germanic language? It doesn't make any sense. In Germanic languages, we end sentences with prepositions. In Germanic languages, we split the infinitives with the signal to in one place and the root in another. And there are other rules like that. So there are probably a lot of things you grew up thinking were rules of English grammar that really aren't rules at all.
Well, one of the interesting parts about it is, of course, that it's conveyed as so much of life. Learning is conveyed as an absolute how it's supposed to be, and it's only much later that one learns there's more relativity than some of the teachers or parents might have wanted to to allow.
Yeah,
thank
and the
you.
Nice thing about English, I find, is that every time I take a closer look at some putative rule of English grammar that seems ridiculous or makes for awkward expressions, I find that, well, that's not really a rule at all. That's a misapprehension. English is very reasonable, and it's evolved in a very reasonable way. The Latinists who tried to graft the rules of Latin onto our grammar in the 18th century felt that English was chaotic, disorderly. It had evolved every which way without any restraints, and it was barbaric, frankly. It was the language of barbarians. And now we're learning that that's really not true. English is very reasonable. There are perfectly good reasons for the true foundations of English grammar, and there are good reasons to get rid of the myths as well.
Hmm. Well, thank the listener for his call. Let's take another call. A listener in Eureka on line two. Hi.
Hi, a very interesting conversation. I agree with you about the teaching of grammar. I just had a quick thought, and I hope this isn't trivial, but it seems to me that telephone conversation can be much more useful and constructive in communication than a lot of email. And I think the caveat you gave about maybe get up, take a walk, cool down before sending an email is useful. But I'm not much of an emailer, but I just do not see the greatest value. There is some value, but I think a well-placed, prepared telephone conversation could be just as useful, because in the telephone conversation, you're getting immediate feedback from the person involved.
Right.
And to me, email has been vastly overrated, except in specific cases where you can find a very concrete reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what your thoughts on that are.
I agree. There are different kinds of communication, and for a lot of communication, it would help to have a back and a forth, a comment, a response.
Yes.
A comment, a response. You know, so you develop in conversation with the other person what it is you both need to know. Whereas if you pour out your whole side of it and then he pours out his whole side of it, you know, things will be missing.
They're like two ships passing in the night.
Right. And a lot of the exchanges that take place in a business workplace, you know, the kind of thing where your desk is just over the partition from the other guy's desk, a lot of those exchanges are things that would be much more productive if they were done either face-to-face or over the phone.
Yeah.
So that there could be, oh, stop right there, I didn't understand what you just said. Or explain that to me. Whereas if someone's sitting all in a solitary splendor emailing something, he gets the feeling that everything that he's putting down is going to be instantly understood.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That may not be the case. There's a lot of room for misunderstanding with email.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Raises a really interesting point. I have a number of people that I need to correspond with later this afternoon after I'm finished on the air. And one of the pieces of correspondence I have to deal with is an email, and it raises many good issues and good ideas. But it's going to take me a while to respond in kind unless I call the individual.
All right. Sometimes it's so much faster to call.
Yeah.
I don't think the telephone is the greatest invention myself. I don't particularly like spending a lot of time on the phone, but to sit down and type out a question and tell someone what it is about his email that you didn't understand and what your response would be if it means A and what your response would mean if it means B, blah, blah, blah. It could just be a few words on the phone, but it's so much more time-consuming to write it all out.
Yeah. Also, you know, you got to be careful with email, because before long you're standing on a soapbox.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And have you noticed that emails can get longer and longer and longer. I find sometimes that my friends will paste in bits that they've like plucked out of a story that was in the New York Times or something, which may be very interesting, but you know, sometimes I'm getting more than I need. It's an embarrassment of riches.
There you go. Let's talk with another listener in Coles County on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes. I was wondering if you had noted that the pronoun me seems to be disappearing from the English language and
yeah.
being replaced by myself.
Uh-huh. Or I
cringed the other evening when a celebrity said they gave it to myself. About the only time me is used anymore is in such sentences as, me and him are going fishing.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I think the single most common error in English right now is probably the misuse of I and me. In other words, using I or myself in place of me.
Correct.
People will say, do you want to come to the movies with Jack and myself? Or do you want to come to the movies with Jack and I? Which neither of those is correct. And I always tell people that if you want to easily figure out which you want, I or me, just knock out the other guy. Do you want to come to the movies with me? You wouldn't say, do you want to come to the movies with myself? Do you want to come to the movies with I? You know, we don't talk like that. So if you simplify your sentence a little bit so that there's only one other guy in it, you'll choose the right one. But you know, it's such a common mistake, and both of our two most recent presidents, Republican and Democrat, have used it. We used to hear Hillary and I. We're glad to see you here with Hillary and I today. And we also say, Laura and I, the presidents use that all the time. So it's not just the guy on the street that gets it wrong. It's from top to bottom.
Well, thank you for your comments on that.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. If someone comes to the door, or if you go to the door and knock, at my door, and I say, who is there? You don't say, it is I.
Well, if I were William F. Buckley, Jr., I might. But I think most people say, it's me.
Yeah.
And grammarians accept that nowadays, that we don't have to say, it is I, or it was I. You can, if you want to be formal, but I think most of us now accept that we don't use that old rule anymore, that with a linking verb like is, you have to use the nominative case rather than the objective case.
Hmm.
So, I think that one's probably behind us. That's one of the few rules of grammar, I think, that have really changed in the last 100 years.
Yeah. So it's a long process.
It is a long process. Vocabulary changes every day. Usage changes every day. Pronunciations change. Words take on new meanings, like agenda. It used to be a list of items. Opera used to be a plural.
Mm-hmm.
It meant works. So things change. But the underlying rules of grammar don't change that often.
Yeah.
Once in a while they do, but not very often.
Are you an early adapter, or are you wary?
Oh, I'm wary.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm very wary. For instance, in the first edition of my book, I was against the use of the word hopefully as a sentence adverb, meaning an adverb that would modify an entire sentence rather than just a particular verb. Now, I'll use an example. Hopefully, I will win the lottery. I was against that sort of thing.
Hmm.
But now I think that probably hopefully has passed over into that whole class of sentence adjectives like frankly or strictly speaking or happily, that kind of thing. We might say happily, he died of natural causes. Well, you're meaning it's a fortunate thing that he didn't die a violent death, but you aren't meaning that he died happy.
Right. Sounds pretty awkward, though.
Yeah. So I think hopefully he's now relaxed to that point also.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Line one, Champagne, hi.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, if time permits. So first of all, am I being unduly critical when I become annoyed when people say, for example, weather-wise, or is that, and that happens on public radio. And
it happens here.
All over the place, and I just wonder if that's a proper usage of words.
It's interesting that you should ask about that, because I was doing some research into something else a couple of weeks ago, and I found that in old English, which is Anglo-Saxon, there was an ending that often got put onto the end of a word, mm-hmm. and it was spelled O-U-S, but it was pronounced is, mm-hmm. is, and it had the same function as this kind of suffix that we have now, wise. So I might say weather-wise, it's nasty out.
Right.
The guy in Old England might have said weather-aus,
okay.
It's nasty out. So it has a history, is what I mean to say. I'm not saying that it's not annoying and it's not overused. I do think it's overused.
Yeah, it just seems like you could figure out something to say other than use the suffix wise,
right,
especially
right,
if you've been
promoted
to.
Yeah, like husband wise, you do a pretty good job,
yeah.
or you know, that kind of thing. It is overused.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to mention that because I did find that it has old roots.
Yeah. My next question is one I wrestle with in my writing and expression, and that is, we're talking about a subordinate clause. And what are the rules, whether it begins with that or begins with which?
Mm-hmm.
And is there a fixed rule that governs that or can guide
yeah,
you?
Yeah, there is. Now, we had a caller earlier who was born in Britain, and I should mention that in British English, they don't make the distinction between that and which that we do here in the United States. But here, the way we treat that and which is that if... Take the clause that you're wondering whether to put that or which at the head of. If you could drop that clause and not lose the point of your sentence, then you want which. And I use an example in my book. Buster's bulldog, which had one white ear, won best in show. See, the which is an unnecessary clause, and it's also set off with commas. You can hear a pause. But information that begins with that is usually more essential to the sentence, as in, the dog that won best in show was Buster's bulldog.
Hmm.
So if the clause is necessary to the sentence, to the meaning, use that. If it's not necessary, if it's just additional information, use which. And also, if you put a pause in your voice around that information as though you're putting commas in, then it's probably which.
Okay. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah.
We've got to wrap it up here. We're out of time. Patricia, it's just been delightful talking with you this afternoon.
Well, thank you.
Patricia O'Connor has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. And listeners, this afternoon, if you give us a call this afternoon to this number, 244-9455, 244-WILL, and make a pledge of financial support of $60 or more, we will send you as a thank you gift this book, Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in plain English. Tom Rogers, our news director, joins me in the studio this afternoon. Hi, Tom.
How are we doing pledge-wise?
Ooh.
I'll run away now.
Let's check in really quickly, can we, with Maeve?
We're doing pretty well. Yeah, let's bring Maeve Riley up right now, and she's in Pledge Central, and we've been having fun talking about English, but in the meantime, we've had some calls come in and ask for the book.
Right, and I'd like to say a quick thanks, if I can, to Steve and Eva Schur, James Fortell, and David Peshkin, who is a former Champaign resident, now lives in Vermont, is here visiting, and wanted to support WILL again.
Oh,
so
terrific.
Thanks a lot to David. We're at $66,750 right now, and you know, that's getting close to where we want to be, but not quite close enough. So give us a call, 217-244-9455.
Yeah, Friday is one of those days where you'll want to keep a pretty solid phone wave going throughout the entire day, especially with this pledge drive in the middle of February, something a little bit new for us. But we want to make sure that we can reach our goals so that we meet our overall goal for the end of the year, which is in the $800,000 range. That money is so important to us, more important than ever, because as we've been mentioning all along during this pledge week, more than half of our operating revenue now comes from you, the listener. You are more important than ever in the grand scheme of things here at AM 580. Start that ball rolling, 217-244-9455. A couple calls already coming in. If you are listening online, if you're not in the area and you have been listening over the internet on WILL.UIUC.edu, if you're on that website right now, there is a button near the top of the page that says Pledge. Click that button now and do your part. Have your say over what you feel is quality radio in East Central Illinois, and thanks to the internet all over the world. 217-244-9455.
And that's it for us at this moment. We're going to join now. We're going to be joined now. Boy, now I'm being a grammar phobe here now. Grammar wise, I'm not doing so well.
We're not grading you though. That's
okay.
Yeah.
Well. All right.
Or maybe we should.
Let's talk with Todd Gleason now. Todd has settlement prices now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Todd, take it away.
And you better be right, too, Todd.
Yeah, well, I hope I get the numbers right. I see enough of my scripts with all kinds of red on them as I type along, watching those things in Word. And Word does a fine job of catching all my misspellings. But unfortunately, I don't do a very good job, and I have tried and tried and tried. And sometimes grammar is tough, too. The which and that thing you were talking about at the end, I'm fairly used to that one because Word is pretty good about pointing that one out as you get into it. But let's point some different things out for this afternoon as we take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade. Kind of a big turnaround day, I suppose. I don't know whether we're going to call this a turnaround just yet or not. In the beans for the day, we'll talk with Mike Zuzolo this afternoon of Risk Management Commodities Incorporated. He's out of Chalmers, Indiana. That comes up at 6 after this next hour after the 2 o'clock Central Time, and we'll talk to him about this move in the bean pit where we've got the May contract up 11, the nearby March was up 9.75, and the deferred November contract up 8.5 cents today. So we'll take a complete look at those numbers with him when we get to him during the closing market report. Let's begin where we always do, in the wheat pit for this afternoon from the Chicago Board of Trade. The nearby soft red winter wheat March contract had a high price today of $2.97.75, a low at $2.94.25. And a settlement price at 294.5. They were down a penny and 3/4 for the day. May futures now 305, the high, the low at 302.25. A settlement price at 303. They're down a penny and a half. And July futures 311, the high, the low at 308.25. Settlement price, as I settle into my cadence for the day, at 309, down 0.75 cents. September futures 315.5, the high, the low at 314.25, settled 314.5. They finished down 0.75 cents, and December contract in the wheat pit, 324.5, the high, the low at 322.5, a settlement price 0.25 cent above the low at 322.75. They were down 0.75 cents. Corn futures finished the day unchanged pretty much across the board, but they had a day that was on either side of that and to the upside for a good portion of the day. March contract, a 199 high, a low at 196.5, a settlement price at 198.25. They were up or unchanged on the day. May unchanged, 206.75, the high, the low at 04, settlement price at 206 for the May. July at 212.5, settlement unchanged with a high of 13 and a low at 10.5. And the September futures, 221, the high, the low at 218 and three quarters, settled 220 and a half. They were unchanged. December contract, this is the harvest month, 231, the high, the low at 228 and a half. Settlement price at 230 and a quarter, unchanged for the day. In March futures, 238, the high, the low at 236 and three quarters. Settlement price at 237 and a half. They were down a quarter. Hey, I was back looking at some of the charts earlier in the day, looking at that December 2005 contract for the corn. You know, Daryl Good always says it goes somewhere to 270, 275. Of course, went there once already, and that was last spring. I think it was up around 285, maybe 286.7, somewhere along those lines. Let's take a look at the March oats now. 169, the high, the low at 162.5. Settlement price at 162.5. They were down three quarters. And the May oats, 159.5, the high, the low at 157.5. A settlement price at 158. They were up a half for the day. March soybeans now from the soy complex, 528.5, the high, low at 516.5, settlement price at 525 and three quarters, up 9 3/4. May futures a 527, high, low at 516, settlement price at $5.26.5, up 11 1/4. July futures 529, the high, the low at 19, and a settlement price at $5.27 3/4, up 9 3/4. August contract for the bean pit, 531.5, the high, the low at 522.5, settled at 530.5, up 9 3/4. In the September futures, gainer there as well, 532, the high, the low at 525.5, settlement price at 531.5. They were up 9.5 cents for the day. New crop November beans, 540.5, the high, the low at 531.5, a settlement price at $5.39, up 8.5 cents for the day. January futures, 545, the high, the low at 40, and a settlement price at $5.44 3/4. They were up 8 3/4. From the rest of the complex, the products like this, bean meal, 158.60 in the March contract on the high, the low at 155.40, settled 157.10. They're up $1.90. And the May meal up $1.90 as well, 156.10. The settlement price with a high of 157.50 and a low at 154.50. Bean oil futures, 2013, the high in the March, the low at 19.20, settled 20.01, up 82. And the May bean oil, 2022, the high, the low at 19.36. Settlement price there at $20.19, and they were up 83 cents for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Prices higher today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, $100.20, the high, $99.65, the low, $100.15, the settlement, that up 55. April, $99.40, the high, $98.90, the low, $99.35, the settlement, that up 15. May, 98.17.5, the high, 97.77.5, the low, 98.02.5, the settlement, that up a nickel. February, live cattle, 90.60, the high, 90 even, the low, 90.10, the settlement, that up 35. April, 87.35, the high, 86.72.5, the low, 86.82.5, the settlement, that up 10. February lean hog, 67.75, the high, 67.30, the low, 67.70, the settlement, that up 67.5. April, 72.70, the high, 71.65, the low, 72.52.5, the settlement, that up 75. May, 73.70, the high, 72.85, the low, 73.70, the settlement, that up 35. June, 76.75, the high, 75.55, the low, the settlement, 76.62.5, that up 80. February bellies, 88.25, the high, 87, even the low, the settlement, 87.60, that down 40 cents. The Dow up 52 points, the NASDAQ 24 higher, the S&P 500 up 9.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agriculture.